Attention patrons of Junk Food Cinema. Let me ask you a question. What could possibly be better than hearing Brian and Cargill be total idiots on a pre-recorded podcast? How about hearing Brian and Cargill be total idiots on a live YouTube show? That's right. As promised, patrons, we are bringing you the first installment of Junk Food Live. You will receive in your email, if you are a patron of Junk Food Cinema, a link to access that live show, which will be Saturday, September 1st at 8 p.m. If you are not already a patron, we highly recommend you go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema and become one before Saturday. On this show, we will have surprise giveaways, we will have big announcements, we will have games that no one should play, and much, much more that will make your parents very sad that this is what you're doing with your life, just like our parents are very sad that this is what we are doing with our life. No matter, Junk Food Live, Saturday, September 1st at 8 p.m. Central Time. Be there or have something better to do.
Beware, non-believers. It is another infernal episode of Junk Food Cinema brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com. And also The Devil. Also brought to you by The Devil. This is, of course, the weekly cult and exploitation filmcast that is so good, you'll probably go to hell for it. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. He's a novelist, he's a screenwriter, he's a lieutenant of Megaforce, he might be the son of Satan himself, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Sanctus Dominus!
Can you imagine if a fucking choir just followed you around
that,
all the time?
I kind of want to see a horror parody that does that. Like, there's just a weird little kid and nobody understands why this choir is always following him around everywhere.
Or if you are the son of the devil and you go to tie your shoe and it's like, and it's just like, guys, all I'm doing is tying my shoe. I literally, like, I'm not trying to kill anyone. This is not a portent.
Tiger shoe! Tiger shoe!
Double loop! Double loop! Like, yeah, it's like, I get it. This is
bunny hoop! Santus! Bunny hoop!
Velcro shoes! Yeah, just all the time. I feel like it would get on your nerves after a while. And as evidence, everyone listening to this is probably like, yeah, gets on your nerves real quick.
Yeah, that joke gets mighty old, my friend. Good thing this is only an hour.
Hey, speaking of jokes getting old, you can find our entire back catalog on Blog Talk Radio and on iTunes. If you go to iTunes, why not leave us a 5-star rating and a review? We really do appreciate that. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. And if you really like the show...
I mean, really like the show.
If you like the show more than...
Damien loves choirs following him around.
Yes, that. Go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. And for as little as $6.66 an episode, you get access to bonus content that no one else gets to hear. Actually, it's as little as a dollar.
A buck.
A buck. But, you know, it's so much more diabolical to say $6.66. We do things like we do mailbags, we do a la modes, we do top fives. If you contribute at the $5 level and above, you actually get access to a whole extra episode called The Deep Dish.
And we're also starting up live shows.
Yes, we are going to do our first live show soon. I'm super excited about that, where you can go on YouTube and it'll just be me and Cargill right there on your screen.
Drinking for an hour
and doing silly things as
and
we are
your questions.
As we are
live.
Live and in person. Live from the gates of hell! Which is exactly where we take you for this week's film. Continuing the summer of 78 and continuing our trend of doing sequels from the summer of 78.
Well, because the summer of 78 really was one of the first big blockbuster sequel years. That's one of the things we haven't really talked about is everyone is trying to recapture this whole blockbuster thing that had just started. And so it's like, well, let's try sequels.
Yeah.
And that little context here that's important is that in this era, sequels were not really a thing. In fact, Roger Corman talks about this a lot as to why he made so many oddball movies that were alike. And it was because sequels were not popular. That was not something you did. You did not make a sequel to something. If something was popular, you made something that was very much like it. So when you have Candy Stripe Nurses do very well, then Roger Corman's thing isn't, oh, we need to make Candy Stripe Nurses 2 and bring the characters back. It's like, no, now we need to make sexy ER nurses and like 12 other nurse movies until they stopped making money. It's why they didn't do Death Race 2001. They did
Death Sport
mm-hmm. and played around with things like that because, hey, this movie did well, so let's make something else like it. Well, this is the era where they started going, what if we just made another movie and just put a number after it?
Well, I'll tell you who's real excited. Oh, first of all, we are talking about Damien, Omen 2.
The Omen also.
Omen again. Oh, man, here we go again.
The terror of the past is but a taste of the future. What happened before was a hint of the horror to come. The first time was only a warning. William Holden, Lee Grant, Damien, Omen 2.
You mustn't attract attention.
You're not going to treat Damien any differently. You're not going to look at him. You're not going to talk to him any differently.
The day will come when everyone will know who you are, but that day is not yet.
I know who you are. Say it, Mark.
You'd better get over here right away.
He needs me.
I need you.
Damien, Omen 2.
Why only other boys and not Damien?
I don't understand.
Damien has a different cell structure.
Different? What does it mean?
I've been working on the story for years now. I think I pieced it together. Oh, please, please, you must listen to me.
The first time was only a warning.
We are all in great danger.
You can't make it believe it.
You've got to believe it. He killed Mark. He killed Atherton and Passeri and Torquay. And he'll keep on killing. He'll kill anyone he thinks is threatening him.
Listen to yourself. Listen to how crazy you sound.
Man, I saw Charles killed. I saw Damien's face on the wall.
William Holden.
Where's Damien?
Lee Grant. Damien, Omen 2, the first time was only a warning.
And one person I know is super excited they made a sequel to The Omen is William Holden.
Mama Damien, here we go again. Mama, Deus on two.
Holy shit, because, oh my God, hold on, stop everything, Jürgen, pause now. The whole point of Mama Mia is trying to figure out who the dad is. What if at the end it's like, it's Satan! It's basically this movie, but as a musical. It's, oh my God, the dad is Satan.
Have you seen the Mamma Mia movies? Because that's how they end.
You can tell me that and I'll have to believe you because I've never seen a Mamma Mia movie.
Oh God, I fucking love the Mamma Mia movies.
But do they really end with the father is the devil?
No. In fact, the beauty of the...
I feel like Mia Farrow would sue the shit out of us.
No, the beauty of the Mamma Mia movies is they never actually find out who the dad is in any of the movies. And nobody cares because she now has three dads. And all of these guys who never had a daughter now have a daughter.
But is one of those dads Paul Reiser or not? Because I'm going to call bullshit.
No, because instead of Paul Reiser, it's British Paul Reiser.
Who's British Paul Reiser?
Colin Firth.
Okay, fair enough. I was like, wait. Who has taken the illustrious title because, of British Paul Reiser?
Because let's face it. Let me put you in an alternate universe because we are at the sidebar. Okay, so alternate universe. Turns out your dad comes to you and he's not really your dad. And your dad is actually one of three dudes that tagged your mother back in the 80s. They are Stellan Skarsgård, Pierce Brosnan, and Colin Firth, do you A, try to figure out and decide between them which one of those awesome dudes you want to be your dad, or you just accept that, hey, I come from all three of these guys like I'm some Greek god sprung from the all the best stuff of these three dudes.
You know what's crazy is I've seen all three of those gentlemen fuck on screen. So
yeah, that's, you have. Could be your mom.
No, no, that's not exactly where I was going with that, but
Sanctus Dominus.
Fuck your mom. Mama, hope. Yeah, no, it's you are the Lars von Trier of my headspace. Like, you just put things in there
and they won't go away.
And they won't go away, and I don't want them there, and I wish you would stop, but you just keep doing it. William Holden.
Look, I'm just saying there's three available holes at any given time, and there's three guys, and there's your mom.
I need to get you a book on how pregnancy works, because two of those won't get it done. William Holden, for the love of God, this is the joke I've been holding on to, is the
You've
guy
William Holden
I've been
on to?
William Holden on to. He is the guy who was very excited that they made an Omen 2, because he was the person originally offered the role that went to Gregory Peck in the first movie. He turned it down. And then when he saw what a monster fucking success The Omen was, he regretted it. And so when the sequel came around, he's like, yes, I will take that. And The Omen 2 is... So if you don't recall the events of The Omen ends with Gregory Peck, America's father at the time. I mean, that's kind of who he was on the big screen.
He was Gregory Peck.
He, don't make me come back there and stab you with one of these daggers. He is about to stab a small child with a dagger. He is convinced that his adopted son is, in fact, the son of the devil, and he has to be slayed.
Spoiler warning, he is, in fact, the son of the devil.
So that doesn't go well. The police burst in and kill him. The mother dies as well, and Damien ends up breaking the fourth wall and staring at the camera, and then, of course, you hear all the...
Dominus!
So that's creepy. In this movie... Damien has grown into, I think he's like 12.
He's 13.
13, excuse me. In this, of course he's 13.
He's 12, about to turn 13, or has just turned 13.
Yeah, 13, such a, of course he's 13. Like, that's the only thing that makes sense. He's living with his uncle, so Gregory Peck's brother, and Gregory Peck's brother's wife. So he has very little biological connection to anyone that he has called family this entire time. And he's going to military academy, which effectively makes Omen 2 the Child's Play 3 of Omen movies, because a lot of this is about the monster being at the military academy. But in this case, the monster is the kid. But what I find so interesting about the sequel to The Omen is that, more so than the first movie, this feels like watching a Final Destination film, because it's all about setting up these kills and setting up how exactly the devil is going to make these dominoes fall in order to take out his enemies. But Damien, for much of this movie, doesn't even have an understanding of how these people that are being killed, some of them he's never met. Some of these people who are being killed, he's absolutely never met. So the devil is killing just indiscriminately to kind of pave the road for Damien without Damien knowing it. And then there are kills that Damien seems to be involved with. So how much of the onus is actually on Damien in a movie called Damien is a little nebulous.
Well, in fact, this is what I love about this movie. This is my favorite Omen movie. I find it the best of all five Omen films that have been made. There are, of course, there's Omen, Damien the Omen 2, the Omen 3. Then there was the Omen 4, which they tried to reboot the series with a little girl.
It was made for TV.
It was made for TV. It is unspeakable. It is garbage.
Not that kind of unspeakable.
No, it is it is truly, like, of all the stuff to watch, there are really only four Omen movies. It falls in a series that does such a great job of playing with continuity and telling a very long story. It just jumps, it just gets completely derailed and is boring and does nothing interesting at all. And then, of course, there's the remake, which was remade from the original script. They just reshot the script, and that did not land. And one of the big reasons it didn't land is they got the wrong child actor who kept like trying to look menacing at things and just looks like he's constipated the whole movie.
Dude, how pissed do you think they are that they didn't wait until now and get the kid from Hereditary?
No, this kid just looks fucking constipated.
And you're absolutely right. That's the problem with the remake, is that because they just did it basically shot for shot again, it felt like Gus Van Sant's Psycho.
Yeah.
Where it's like, okay, you did it, but so what?
But I would rather watch Richard Donner's version. Yeah. Like, Richard Donner fucking nailed it. And I love Donner's version. Donner version is great. This is the movie that gave me nightmares as a kid, and this is the movie that I feel is far more interestingly realized, because the plot of this movie involves the son of the devil not knowing he's the son of the devil,
yeah,
surrounded by people who are looking after him and protecting him so that he can rise to power and they can be in power along with him. And then him slowly realizing, finding out the truth, rejecting the truth, and then slowly embracing the truth as he realizes all of these people that know who he is either hate him or want to kill him. And all of a sudden, you see the change, and the change makes sense. That, oh God, these people are just going to kill me. Well, fuck it. I may as well embrace who I am. And that's the movie. Like, that is the bulk of the movie. It is about people discovering who Damien is and then dying terribly with their piece of the puzzle. And when I say terribly...
Oh my God, the kills in this movie.
The kills in this movie are probably the best conceived kills of any horror movie ever.
Yeah.
I mean that. Now, they're not all the best executed kills. They are not the best kills ever. But let's walk you through what fears this movie plays with. Buried alive.
Oh my God.
Drowning, yep, under, not just drowning under ice and being able to see people trying to free you from ice as you are freezing and to death while drowning. Death by elevator, which, psych out, you're getting cut in half by a cable instead.
That's the most Final Destination moment of this whole fucking movie.
Oh, this, I guarantee you that kill inspired Final Destination. I guarantee fucking to you. Wandering out into the road and getting hit by a tractor trailer, then bouncing off the top of the tractor trailer before almost getting run over by the wheel of a tractor trailer.
I'm going to stop you there. If this movie has a flaw, it's the end of that scene, because I know what they're going for and it's great, but when your dummy lands and then the wig comes off of the dummy and it's clearly a male dummy,
is,
maybe,
yeah,
you should cut that last frame out of there. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah,
don't cut the whole kill. Just the last frame where the dummy's wig comes off. That's all I'm going to say.
That is a fair critique. Still, that scene fucked me up as a kid.
Oh, no. A lot of these kills are on... I mean, there is something about...
The train kill.
Oh
my God, the train kill when somebody gets caught between the couplings,
yeah,
of two trains.
Thou shalt not couple.
This movie is gnarly in, yeah, terms of the deaths, and they're the things that get to your deep-seated fears, and that's what's so amazing about this film is it's not just... It's not about being gruesome, because this movie isn't very gruesome. There's only one really gory shot in this film.
By the way, I know exactly the one you're talking about, and I wasn't going to get into this so early, but can we talk about who the victim of that elevator kill is?
Please.
The victim of the elevator kill is Meshach Taylor, who I have always known my entire life as Hollywood from Mannequin.
Yeah.
And he was also, you know, huge on designing women. Like,
yeah,
a fucking staple of the 80s.
Yeah, he one of the great 80s supporting characters, and he is playing a doctor here that gets cut in half with a great intestine gag. Like, yeah, it's really, like, really top-notch stuff for the era. And
he gets
killed,
by the way, for discovering, because Damien's in the hospital, and he takes a sample of his blood and realizes that it is genetically similar not to a human but to a jackal. And that's why he has to die, is because he's the only one that knows the truth. So he gets on that elevator. He gets on an elevator in what I assume is some kind of 70s era dystopian sci-fi. This fucking elevator looks like It should be in Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory.
Keep in mind that the original... So this is what's important. The original movie takes place in 1976. This movie, though made 2 years later, would be taking place 7 years later.
Right.
So they're trying to make what it looks like in the 80s. They are very subtle about it. They're not like, you're living in the future. But there are a couple things that are very much, hey, this is what we think technology will be like in the 80s.
And they prophesied that in the 80s, elevators would be spectacularly unsafe. And that kill where that cord just comes down and cuts right through. Because you think, like, the car is plummeting. You think that's how he's going to die. And then right before it hits the ground, it stops. And then that cable just comes through and cuts everything. And then it's just like, Dominos Hollywood! And he's dead. Like, it's fucking crazy that in one of his first roles, he gets the most gruesome kill in a horror sequel.
Yeah, and it is... It is, yeah. And that's the most gruesome in terms of the blood effects.
Oh, yeah.
But you get to pick your death in this one because they're all bad. The guy who gets gassed to death.
Yeah.
I mean, like, this is nothing but all of your favorite fears rolled up into one fucking death sequence. And then, of course, you know, these movies being what they are, the first two movies always end with Damien winning. Like,
yeah, and this is the only movie, as we've kind of touched upon, this is the only movie in the series where at any point Damien doesn't know he's the son of the devil. Because even in that first movie, it seemed like that kid fucking knew. I mean, the last shot of the original Omen is him looking at the camera like, I fucking won. So this is the only
movie. It's all for you, Damien.
Bitch, I know. I'm Damien. And in this movie, he goes through a period where, like, when he finds that birthmark, that scene is so interesting because the rest of this franchise... He is full on aware that he is the son of the devil. In fact, I, in preparation for this episode, did not just watch The Omen 2. I watched The Omen 3, The Final Conflict, which was released most places just as The Final Conflict. And
it's the Final Conflict is I walk into a church and there's a lot of light and the movie's over.
Yeah, Sam Neill.
There's not so much conflict in The Final Conflict.
Sam Neill is great in that movie.
Sam Neill is really great as old Damien.
He's even they work to maintain his haircut. Did you notice that? Like,
yeah.
It's the same fucking haircut.
Yeah, no, that's what's so interesting about this horror series is you can sit down and watch it in a triple feature, and it is a narrative.
Yeah.
And it's a great narrative until the last 5 minutes, at which point you're like, ah! Point of order. So Jesus just shows up and we don't get to watch Jesus like winning or kicking the shit out of anybody.
Jesus didn't do shit. Jesus didn't do shit in that movie.
Jesus
he
just shows
up after. Okay. Spoiler alert for Damien 3, The Final Conflict. Okay. You're still here. So I guess you want to know this. Damien is not killed by Jesus. Damien is killed by a woman he's been seeing with one of the daggers of Megadon or whatever the fuck they're called. The daggers of the giant shark. I don't know. Maybe that is what they're called. But he's already dead when Jesus shows up. So is it like, haha? Like, Jesus just shows up to gloat? Is it gloat ex machina? Is that what we're
saying? I think that the point of the narrative is supposed to be that once the son of the devil dies, that Jesus can come back. Like, this is the, like, as long as he still remains and stays alive, he is keeping Jesus from returning to earth. I think that's kind of the point. But again, they flubbed the ending of that movie. It felt like a movie. It really feels like a movie where they had an even better movie planned and then the budget fell short and they're like, we can't.
Somebody off screen is just doing rap.
We can't.
Rap
like, guys, seriously, we can't do a movie about the apocalypse. And it's like, that's what we've been building towards.
It's literally called The Final Conflict.
Like, it's about that. We've been talking about Revelations for two movies now. Can we show Revelations? And it's like, dude, it's 1980. How are we going to do a thousand-eyed beast? Like, how are we going to do that on this budget? No, we're not. By the way, as somebody who grew up Catholic, if you've never read Revelations, you have never read anything like it was inspired by drugs until you've read Revelation cover to cover. Like, you think it might be like like a serious prophecy thing. By the way, the Catholic Church does not believe it as a prophecy. It believes it as a story.
That's why I always believed that Revelations was written by H.P. Lovecraft.
It is, yeah. There's, you get like trumpet blowing lions and like just crazy shit, and it's like, what the actual fuck is going on here?
Yeah.
And so I love that. That I feel like they wanted to make, like, we're gonna fucking do that. We're gonna show the throng of 144,000. It's gonna be fucking great. Yeah, no, you're gonna get 140 extras, and we're gonna have some lights behind a cross, and it's gonna be amazing.
And they also completely abandoned. I mean, we talk about internal logic all the time. They established that if you're gonna, like, in the first omen, they establish if you're going to kill Damien, you have to do it with all 7 daggers in a church. Like inside, you know, the actual, God, I want to say cathedral. I am failing miserably as the husband of a Catholic. The place where they actually do the worshiping, the rectory. No, I don't know. They have to be in that room, right?
The chapel.
Thank you. In the chapel. But she stabs him with one outside and he's done. And it's like, okay. Honestly though, I loved the third movie. I loved the final conflict, except for the amount of baby murder. It was a little too much baby murder for me to handle. But other than that, like, I actually really dug it. And you talk about the kills in this movie. The one I think could rival it is the first monastery assassin, how he goes, because he's up on that scaffolding and he trips and falls during a television taping. And he gets caught, his ankle gets caught on a wire, so he starts swinging back and forth. But he started a fire, and he flies through, like, a cellophane, like, divider directly into the fire. And then it just, like, encases him in fire as he's swinging back and forth. And I'm like, that's the most horrific way I could possibly imagine to
die.
It's
pretty bad.
Holy shit.
But yeah, no, I also like the final conflict. It's just, it's not nearly as good as 1 and 2.
No.
And the ending kind of blows what's really going well, because this movie, you know, where this movie goes and how it ends, it is, I love how it breaks all the rules and ends with, oh God, the bad guy won again.
Yeah.
And in the way that it happens and how depressing it is, and the big revelation at the end that, hey, by the way, this person that has, you know, been this loving mother this whole time is really just somebody who's been set up to protect Damien again, is kind of fucking awesome.
Yeah.
And you know what we haven't talked about yet?
A lot. but what specifically?
I mean, yeah, but like, there is a big junk food favorite in this movie.
Oh, that's true. In a very early role.
In a very early role. And this is just after he hopped off a train.
I wouldn't use that expression in this movie. Just
But I'm serious, because I don't know if I've talked about this on the main show before, but we, of course, are talking about Lance Henriksen.
Oh, yeah.
And a couple of years ago, I ended up at a con with Lance Henriksen, and we were both having really rough days. We both stepped out at the exact same time for a cigarette and ended up smoking 3 cigarettes together out there, just having a great time chatting. And he was the coolest fucking guy. And we just got very serious very quick. And he talked to me about what it was like being a 29-year-old who just got sick and tired of his life. As a teenager, who got sick and tired of his life in a small town, literally hopped a train and just kind of milled around and then landed in Los Angeles when he was 29 and fell into acting. And that, of course, you know, changed his life. But it was never what he set out to do and was never his plan. And this is like right early on after he hopped off a train and was in Hollywood and is playing this guy who is a sergeant at the military academy, who you come to find out soon enough is one of his overseers and is the one that explains to him, hey, by the way, you're the son of the devil. Or we say son of the devil. That's one of the things thrown around. One of the other elements that's also brought up is that he is the devil made flesh. So the real in the mythology, is he actually the devil himself, given form here on earth, or is he the son of the devil, the way Jesus is the son of God? Or in true Catholic fashion, is it one of all three? Like, is there an unholy trinity where you have, you know, the Father, the Son, and the evil spirit, you know, the thing that's going around and killing for Damien while Damien is unaware of the danger surrounding him?
Yeah.
But so Lance Henriksen is really good in this.
He's great in this. He apparently did not love being in this because he was brought on by Mike Hodges, who was the original director. Mike Hodges, of course, the director of... Dominoes! Flash Dominoes!
The son of Satan! Savior of the universe!
I would believe that Ming the Merciless is the son of Satan. I would buy that in a heartbeat. Man. And then his castle looks like a giant...
The great god Diagon. Actually Satan.
Hold on. And Zoltan and all of his warriors are kind of like angels. So this...
Voltan.
I'm sorry, Voltan. We're getting into some weird, like... Catholic underscores to Flash Gordon that I never really thought about before.
I feel like we need to revisit the Flash Gordon episode.
Oh yeah, we're going to.
At some Take point. Well, yeah, because I've learned new stuff about Flash Gordon that is crazy and that isn't like really out there. So we may have a Flash 2 back to the Gordoning.
The final conflict. We can actually shortlist that for when we finish Summer of 78. I'm totally fine with that.
Apparently we have to shortlist Small Soldiers, or our Twitter feed is just
going
to...
I love it.
Yeah, you do.
I love that someone has taken it upon themselves to tweet at us every day that we need to do Small Soldier.
Fucker, just wait till we're done with the Summer of 78.
No.
And then hassle us.
And I love that it's like repurposing stills from Small Soldiers and then saying that it has something to do with like behind the scenes at Junk Food Cinema. Like, all of this is magic to me. I am so excited for that. So yeah, but anyway, Lance Henriksen was brought on by Mike Hodges, had a really good rapport with him, and with Mike Hodges was... axed for creative differences, and they brought in Don Taylor. He didn't really get along with Don Taylor. There was a lot of on-set kind of drama, which, you know, is pretty impressive considering Lance Henriksen was still like trying to make his bones in the industry and had the confidence to kind of, you know, swing his dick around.
Well, but directors. That's something that Lance Henriksen straight up told me, that when he was younger, he was just angry. Mm-hmm. Like, in fact, that's what we talked about. Cause the reason we got very serious, very quick was I had just had a fan come up and talk to me about suicide. And he had just had some fans come up that got very real with him.
Yeah.
And when I mentioned the suicide thing, he goes, "Oh man, suicide. You know, that's something I've never been able to understand. Cause when I was a teenager, I was just so angry, just so mad at everybody. And it just took me a long time to get over just being so angry at everyone. I was just too angry to want to take it out of myself." And it was, and it's like, when Lance Henriksen says that to you in that low, deep growl, yeah, that goes from being deep shit to being Jesus Christ deep shit. God, we got into a dark conversation quick. It was one of the greatest conversations I've ever had in my life. I will be telling that story to my grave.
Maybe we don't know it, but it's actually Lance Henriksen that shows up at the end of Damien 3 and all that basked in all that light, and we just didn't recognize him.
Yeah, but but it doesn't surprise me that he was angry at that point. Like, he was still young. He was still... He had not become that, because now he's this person who's very thankful. He loves work. He just loves working. When you talk to him about people he's worked with, he feels so thankful to have had a chance to work with them. But in 1978, maybe not so much.
Yeah, in this movie, I will say that Richard Donner was asked to come back and direct, and he wanted to. But in 1978, he was busy trying to make you believe that a man could fly.
And busy probably falling in love with the producer of Thank God It's Friday.
Man, all of these things just wrapped up so nicely, right? Hey, Superman, Summer of 78 movie, you might want to just put that one on your radar. We might be talking about that. I don't know.
Theoretically, we could talk about that. It might come up.
It could, you know, just saying.
Did that actually release in the summer?
I don't think it did. Now that
that's
why
I'm pretty certain it was Christmas.
But we're gonna fucking flub it and talk it. Of course, we're gonna talk about Superman.
Take a drink, junkies, because you'll believe a man can fly,
and you'll believe that December can be in the summer,
and you'll believe that we both have this on Blu-ray, because of course we do.
I feel like that's the least hard thing to believe. You will believe they own this movie on Blu-ray. That's interesting, though, that he was asked to come back. He wasn't able to. He ended up producing... did he produce this one as well? Because I know he produced the third one.
I'm not certain.
I don't remember seeing his name in the credits, though, as a producer on Omen 2. But the actor who plays Damien, his name is Jonathan Scott Taylor. He had really only been in one movie prior to this, which was Bugsy Malone with Scott Baio and Jodie Foster, that weird sort of kiddie mafia movie. And after this, they tried to... The third Omen originally was going to be another story about him starring, you know, Jonathan Scott Taylor. But because The Omen 2 did not reach anticipated financial success, they kind of scrapped that idea. And this kid who's great in this movie just decided to give up acting and became a lawyer. So it's just really unfortunate that we didn't get...
Kind of like Chunk. Yeah. That's exactly what happened to Chunk. He decided to give up acting and became a lawyer.
You know, I was wondering why at one point they make the son of the devil do the truffle shuffle. So I'm glad you shed some light on that. Truffle shuffle! But yeah, one of the...
Okay, you know what? We keep doing this.
Yeah.
Let's also mention, this is an amazing score by Jerry Goldsmith.
Yeah.
That is so much fun to mock because it's become so iconic, no one else can do it.
That's true. That's entirely
like,
true.
Like, they did it, they had an episode of... they had an episode of South Park where they had this creepy little kid that was that the choir kept singing every time they close up eyes, and you're like, oh, that's the son of the devil, clearly.
You get
like
it.
That's you get it because Jerry Goldsmith so fucking nails this.
Yeah.
And it's so cool and it adds to the power of this movie, but it's so of its time and it's so what it is that of course we have to have fun with it because there's no other movie that quite does this.
Dude. When the Ravens have a musical cue, and it's, I don't even know how to describe it, because it's not that. It's not the choir. It's like deep voice. Like it's Lance Henriksen going, brruh. It's almost Lance Henriksen doing a ribbit for a crow. It's really hard to describe, but every time it happened, I was uncomfortable. I was like, there's something about the devil in general. Much as I'm not necessarily the world's most religious person, the devil scares the shit out of me.
Well, that's what's so great about these movies and why I wish The Final Conflict hadn't have flubbed the ending is because the great thing about these movies is what is terrifying about the devil is you can't beat the devil.
Yeah.
You know, and the few bits of narrative that we have of somebody beating the devil, it's always kind of in a tongue-in-cheek sort of way, or like in the best beating the devil fashion ever. My favorite beating the devil story is, of course, at the end of one of the John Constantine comics, which they kind of they lift from for Constantine.
By the way, I dig that movie.
I dig Constantine too.
I feel like it got unfairly shit upon.
Okay, guys. Take a drink,
because
we'll definitely cover Constantine at some point. Because I have stories about Constantine to tell, but also it's a genuinely good movie. But in the original comic, you know Constantine tricks the devil into having a beer with him before the devil collects his soul, and what he doesn't realize is he's had the water blessed into holy water that he turned into beer. So he's brewed holy beer and has just offered the devil a holy beer. And the devil, of course, and it's a really good ending. But still, even then, it's kind of a comical ending. You don't really beat the devil. The devil will always get his due, which is what's so great about the mythology of the devil and why it works in these movies, because no one ever wins these movies.
I don't know. There was one very famous fiddle competition in Georgia.
Again, tongue-in-cheek. Like, The Devil Went Down to Georgia is a great fucking story,
also,
but it's also...
Can we finally say this on the air? The devil fucking wins that competition. If you listen to that song,
oh, yeah.
The devil's portion of it is so much better than Johnny.
That's the whole point of that song. That's what's so great. Charlie Daniels, before he went crazy, was pretty fucking great. And now he oh my God.
Is he another one of those celebrities who someone should take his Twitter feed from?
Yeah, but in a different way. Like he is one of those crazy right wing guys, but what like the craziest thing he did was yelled at Taco Bell for using iconography of the Illuminati, because the the Illuminati is a serious thing and not to be joked about. And it is, oh, you're bringing up your phones. You're like, I got to see Charlie Daniel tweet about the Illuminati. It's fucking true. Charlie Daniels believes like the Illuminati is not something to joke about.
So, speaking of the Illuminati not being something to joke about, this is a real story from my real life in the last few days. So, I walk into the bathroom. Our main bathroom happens to also be, like, the one adjacent to my stepson's room. So, I walk in there, I'm doing my business, and I happen to look up, and...
I don't really want to know, but doing your business could be one of three things.
I'm taking a leak.
I'm in the bathroom doing my business.
I have a lot of business
that takes place in the bathroom.
I take a lot of meetings that happen to be in the bathroom. In fact, that's what I used to call taking a shit. So I have to go take a meeting, and I'm glad this is.
You don't
what
have
we're
to
talking.
Drop the kids off at the pool.
You know, the
Browns to the Super Bowl.
Take the Browns to the Super Bowl. All kinds of things. Trying to. Dance around it and be classy is the fucking word I was looking for. So I happen to look up and he has a notebook that he has written in. And I will show you this picture. He has written across the top Illuminati, his name, my name, his brother's name, my wife's name, his cousin's name, names, and then a triangle. Who the fuck taught my 7-year-old son about the Illuminati?
Charlie Daniels.
Apparently it's Charlie...
The Illuminati went down to Georgia.
I was fucking terrified. And this was right after I had watched The Omen 2. So I was like, what the fuck is going on in my house? Because
Lance Henriksen's about to teach him pyramid schemes. And about the Elders of Zion. It's going to be great.
I mean, the only pyramid scheme I imagine Lance Henriksen has been near was the pyramid from Alien vs. Predator. But, you know, that's another story for another day. But yeah, that freaked me the fuck out. I'm like, should I be worried or should I be thankful that he has put my name on the list so apparently I will be spared from whatever uprising is imminent? I was terrified.
I'm honestly guessing one of the kids from school showed him the weird stuff in the back of the dollar bill.
I hope so.
That it's really like, it's the Illuminati. What's that? I don't know. You'll have to ask my uncle Charlie Daniels. He says a lot of stuff that I don't understand.
Insert the sound effect from Taco Bell here. Anyway, coming back to The Omen 2, Stargrove.
The Omen also. Stargrove. Tango.
Tango.
Cashinus. You know what? We're probably the only ones amused by this, and I don't give a shit.
You know when the joke is run out of steam and you do it anyway, and the more you do it, the more you know it's past the point where you should stop doing it.
It's kind of the last 42 years of my life. Yes, yeah. I know exactly what that's like.
The last, like, 6 seasons of Family Guy.
6.
The point is, I don't know how many.
And all of the Cleveland Show, yes. And American Dad.
By the way, just slight bone I have to pick with Family Guy just for a second. In the same episode where they accuse A Christmas Story of being totally racist, which, yes, it has that scene at the end with the Chinese waiters, and yes, that's racist, racially insensitive. In that same episode, they make a joke about Miracle on 134th Street, and a white guy leaves his cell phone in his car in Harlem, and it's still there when he comes out, and it's a miracle. And I'm like, McFarlane, you really want to talk about who's racist, you motherfucker? Anyway, Omen 2 is what
Omen 2.
Omen, here we go again. My, I could never let you go. I do find it, one thing I had difficulty with in this movie was keeping straight all of the 70s square faces. There are so many white dudes with square faces in this movie.
There is a lot of white square facing in this.
It's like the blockheads from Gumby, but wearing corduroy jackets. Like, it's just, it was a lot to keep up with. But I will say, pursuant to something we talked about during Thank God It's Friday, Friday.
Thank God it's Friday.
Thank you, God, for it officially being Friday. We lift up all praise to you for the day when we will get mudslides at TGI Fridays. The thing that we talked about is that this series, Summer of 78, has allowed us to really talk about the worst fashion of all time. And I think in The Omen 2, I may have found the most 70s suit. And the single most 70s suit is a brown corduroy sport coat over a blue dress shirt with a red macrame tie. I'm going to repeat that.
A brown corduroy sport coat over a blue dress shirt with a red macrame tie.
A tie that it looks like Disco Granny made for him. It is atrocious. This is something that people wore in front of other people. It's nuts. You're shrugging like this is something you would have worn.
Well, I mean, having lived through this time, I remember people wearing that seriously. And so I'm like, it's not the worst mistake I've seen.
It is such a terrible 70s suit that I actually saw Jason Murphy wearing it now. That's how bad a 70s suit it is. That guy loves him some 70s leisure suits.
He's
all about it.
He really does.
Oh, you and I are going to have words.
You know who we have not mentioned yet? Sylvia Sidney.
Yes.
Sylvia Sidney, classic, you know, classic actress. This is one of those later roles, but not even close to the latest of her roles. Like, she would go on to do stuff all the way into the 90s in a bunch of junk food favorites.
Oh, one I know that you are all familiar with is she's Juno the caseworker from Beetlejuice.
She's in Beetlejuice. She's in Mars Attacks.
Yep.
As grandma. She did a lot of television, but it's kind of interesting. Like, she's, you know, she's in and out of stuff in her later years. Like, after Hollywood would usually have no role for her, she would have three more classic movies in her in the last 15 years.
By the way, she plays the, quote, senile old aunt who first kind of becomes aware that there's something really wrong with Damien. And hilariously, William Holden was 59, and that made him only 8 years younger than Sylvia Sidney, who's supposed to be the crazy old aunt.
Well, To be fair, she is the aunt and not the mother.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have an aunt who is 5 years older than me, because it all depends on how many people were in your family. If you've got enough.
Oh, I got the impression she was William Holden's aunt.
Yeah. I got the impression William Holden's aunt as well. But that doesn't mean that, you know, because it's
aunt. I guess that's true.
That means she's the sister
It's not so much the family thing as it is they play her up as being old and senile.
She's the matron. She's the eldest of the generation. She controls way too much of the company. And what I love about it is they love playing up the whole old rich element of this.
Oh, yeah.
Where she's like throwing around, like, it's the, you're going to do what I say because you're going to want the inheritance because I'm going to die sometime soon.
Yeah.
So fucking listen to me. And
it's like if Satan moved to Downton Abbey. There's a lot of what's going on here.
Devil went down to Downton.
Devil went down to Abbey. I want to produce this show. Let's get Netflix on the phone. Oh, we're already greenlit for 2 seasons. Thanks, Netflix. Appreciate that. But yeah, she's the first. And the way this movie opens, I think, is really fucking fantastic, because it opens pretty much days after the funeral of Gregory Peck. And it's the same archaeologist from the first movie. I forget what is it? Bugenhagen, which I believe was a demon in your movie.
No,
is that not true? I may have misread the subtitles.
Bugenhagen is a really great beer.
That's true. It's delicious. It's an infernally great beer, Bugenhagen. So he confides in one of his friends that he has found this ancient wall from this monk that went insane after apparently seeing the face of the devil. And carved on the wall are the various forms of the son of the devil at various ages. And wouldn't you know it, one of them looks exactly like Damien. But in the process of visiting this wall that happens to be in a cave underground, the whole thing collapses and they're buried alive in one of the most traumatic scenes of the whole movie. And then seven years later.
And by the way, that scene goes on. Like, you'd expect, hey, we're going to drop in a bunch of sand. No, they're trapped and we're going to spend a minute and a half watching sand slowly pour over them.
Yeah.
As they slowly drown in sand.
It's horrendous. And then it's 7 years later. By the way, we mentioned that this movie is kind of predicting the future. In that it's, you know, it's when it was made versus, you know, jumping ahead 7 years. Do you know one thing that The Omen 3 doesn't give a shit about? Is adhering to that.
Right.
Because that's supposed to be 20 years after this movie. And it's made in 1981, and they talk about in that movie how it's about to be 1984. That doesn't fucking line up at all.
No, there's a lot that doesn't line up in the third movie. Like,
guys, you have to try a little bit harder. Just for me, just work a little bit harder to make that timeline function. But no, they're not so much interested.
One of the other interesting things about this movie is who the villain, like the other villain is, the sub-villain. Because the villain of this movie, clearly Damien, son of the devil.
Damien!
The other villain of this movie is Monsanto.
It's true. It's so fucking true.
Like, there's this whole subplot about the guy who is overseeing protecting Damien, who's clearly one of the devil's devotees, who is taking over the company, and his big plan is to buy up all this land in all of these developing countries that are starving to grow food that they will control the seed and they will control the pesticide, and that they will be feeding the locals. Essentially turning them into serfs.
Yeah.
And there's some people in the company initially who are like, dude, that's fucking evil. Yeah. That's illegal. Like, it's not illegal. We're the first ones to do it. Well, it's unethical.
Yeah.
Like, there's like, clearly this is like, no, this is wrong. But they win. So yeah, it's really interesting that the movie's subtext is talking about the evils of big farms. Of
big agricultural conglomerates.
Yeah, which of course is the world we live in right now. Like, every bit of, like, we have all today eaten food from the same company. I guarantee you there are four major food companies that do everything, and most people can't name them. But yeah, it's crazy how anti-mega farm this movie ultimately is.
They're the four horsemen of the food apocalypse, which, you know, is upon us. And this junk food actually is one of the heralds of the food apocalypse, I feel.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a depressing way to talk about it.
Actually, I'm going to put that on business cards from now on. And the junk food cinema, one of the heralds of the food apocalypse. I'm okay with that. But one of the things that I wasn't expecting with this movie, and I don't really know why I wasn't expecting this, the cinematography for a horror sequel in a time when they weren't really making horror sequels is gorgeous.
Well, but that was a hallmark of the Omen movies. The Omen movies are what I always think of when I think of classy 70s horror. Like, that's the thing, is this subgroup of Catholic horror that really kind of evolved from the success of The Exorcist is very classy, and indicative of that is the cinematography. That this needs to look big. This needs to look majestic. This needs to feel like we've spent money on it, that it has high production value just in terms of the cinematography. This is big, because this is not your average horror movie. This is not A Couple of Kids in the Cabin. This is not a car breaking down at the side of the woods. This is everything. This is a huge, huge problem and a huge threat. And that's what I love about 70s Catholic filmmaking, is that is one of the hallmarks. You don't make a shitty shot Catholic horror film in the 70s. Now, ultimately, we would fall into lots of cheap Exorcist knockoffs and, you know, the resurgence of exorcism in Catholic films in the aughts, in which I personally, you know, biased as I am, I think the best one and the best shot one is Scott's Exorcism of Emily Rose from that era. But then again, you see something really cool, like the movie Eli Roth produced, The Last Exorcist, which we'll talk about at some point, because that's a movie that deserves to be revisited by folks, because that movie's not what people think it is, and I love it. So we'll talk about that in the future, but I still think the best shot is and the best of them is Exorcism of Emily Rose. But yeah, that was something that got lost. But yeah, this movie fits in. It's bowled up right the middle. This is not a movie that ever needs to apologize for anything. This movie does everything it's trying to do. It looks beautiful. It's well acted. You know, all the production value is great. The only thing it has to apologize for is it's the last time the the series is good. Because from then on, there's issues with everything. But yeah, no, I adore the look of this movie. And that's one of the things I've always thought about. Like, you know, the Omen gave us the Richard Donner that would then make so many great films after. It's so weird that the Omen is kind of a footnote in Richard Donner's career, that everything he would do after that is like, oh, holy shit, this guy's made all these huge classic films. And oh yeah, he also made The Omen early in his career.
He is one of those directors, kind of like a Danny Boyle or a Takashi Miike, who can kind of play in any genre and do it well. And, I mean, when you think about The Omen, you think about Superman, you think about the fucking Lethal Weapon movies? Like...
Goonies,
what the fuck? Like
yeah, no, Richard Donner.
Nothing he can't do.
Richard Donner was all over the place, but in the best way. And it's weird to, you know, it's like, oh, wait, yeah, the guy who did The Omen did all of that. He made what was the best superhero movie for decades. One of the best kids movies of the 80s. Made one of the greatest buddy cop movies of all time. And made one of the greatest Catholic horror movies of all time. Like, this guy... You know, so much of what he touched became classic. And that's what's weird is that, oh, yeah, he also did The Omen.
Yeah, and it's like even his movies that aren't as well regarded still have like really vehement fan bases. Like I have met so many people who are in love with Lady Hawk.
Oh, I love Lady. You know, the thing is Lady Hawk, we may talk about at some point. I don't know. Lady Hawk is a great film with a terrible score. And the score was so of its time that it is so dated and doesn't work for the way we look at fantasy films that so much of that film is undercut. I feel like if you got someone like Bear McCreary to go in and cut their own version of a score for Lady Hawk and showed it to people, you would instantly see it as a classic. Because conceptually speaking, it's so fucking good. But... that score just makes it so goofy at times. But yeah, no, that movie's great.
Well, there you have. I mean, yeah, he's definitely a director. And he's one of those guys that you'll like movies of his before you realize they're his, like Scrooged and Maverick. I fucking love Maverick, by the way.
So do I. You know, I have a love for Assassins.
I've never seen Assassins.
That's we need to sit down together with a six pack and watch Assassins, because that's a piece of history. That is really interesting. And I just actually had a great conversation with Lana Wachowski about it up in Chicago a few months ago. And it's a really interesting movie, how that came together and how that movie formed who the Wachowskis became. Like, because of what happened with Assassins, we got The Matrix. I love Maverick. Maverick is an underrated one.
I've never seen Conspiracy Theory. I know that's...
Oh, Conspiracy Theory is cool. Like, that's a movie that was really cool at the time. That's worth revisiting. I especially think it might hold up even better now that Mel Gibson is legitimately crazy. And looking back on it as what if this really was just Mel Gibson at the time saying, I want to make a movie about my daily life.
Well, and the other thing is this. It's... that, for one. And two, we live in an era where the craziest conspiracy theory you could possibly think up is not as crazy as what's actually going on in government. So I feel like you're right. I feel like there's a couple reasons conspiracy theory might hold up today.
Yeah, but so... But again, Richard Donner didn't direct this film. This film was directed by somebody else entirely.
One of the things I find fascinating about The Omen 2 in terms of the history of horror is that its failure, I believe that its failure actually gave a foothold to a completely new movement in horror and led to the augmented success of one of our favorite directors of all time. Because when The Omen 2 fails to make a big splash at the box office, this comes on the heels of The Exorcist 2, The Heretic, also failing at the box office. And at this time, like you had mentioned, in the 70s, in the mid to late 70s, audiences were in love with the idea of possessed children and the devil kind of being reborn. Like Rosemary's Baby obviously was a huge hit. And when these movies start to peter off, audiences are looking for the next big thing in horror. And what do they get in 1978? but an American version of a genre that had been very big in Italy, but had not really taken hold here. This whole idea of a slasher film. And Halloween comes out right as The Omen 2 fails to connect with audiences. I feel like The Omen 2 signals the end of the Devil Child being all the rage in American horror and giving rise to the American slasher. And it's such a fascinating sort of handing off of the baton that because audiences were so hungry for something new, may explain, I mean, of course, Halloween is an amazing film, so a lot of its credit is due to itself, but it might help to explain why Halloween became one of the most successful independent films of all time. Because I feel like audiences were ready for, okay, what's the next thing in horror? Like, we're ready. We're done with...
Well, but that's also that, you know, you go from this hyper-produced kind of horror, this very good-looking horror, to something raw that feels like it's right next to you. Mm-hmm. It's very scary. It's very inventive.
Yeah.
And shatters the mold and creates a whole new mold that would then be copy and pasted for decades. But yeah, no, I'm in total agreement with you.
It's something I never considered until you start looking at, you know, especially The Exorcist being such a huge cultural touchstone, and then the second one, and then The Omen 2, you know, like not living up, and people were just, they got tired of it. And it happens in horror. Like, it's actually, you know, something you mentioned about Halloween, about how it feels like it's right next to you and it's raw and it's a little scarier for that. That might also be the reason why people embraced found footage when that became a big deal.
Oh, that's exactly why found footage worked.
Because it's like, it's even closer to me now. Like, that, yeah. A lot of the fourth wall safety net that I had is broken. So you could theorize about it all day, but it is a really interesting topic. And before we wrap up, I do want to mention a lot of Damien's machinations and the devil working on his behalf is very Final Destination. Very, anyone who looks at Damien cross-eyed has this bizarre accident happen and nobody seems to put the pieces together and it's all just terrible. It's like Hot Fuzz where it's like, don't you find it strange that the murder rate is so low, but the accident rate is so high? Like nobody put the pieces together. William Holden died in a really bizarre way shortly after this film, where he fell in his home and hit his head on an end table and died. Part of me thinks we need to reopen that case and see if the devil was involved, because that sounds like a Damien accident to me.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
It's a little suspicious is all I'm going to say.
I would like to mention Don Taylor, because we spent so much time talking about Richard Donner. We may actually talk about the actual director here.
Yeah.
Now, the reason why we haven't had a whole lot to say is because Don Taylor was just a gun for hire. He was a guy who was a gun for hire as an actor, did tons of TV, actually started one of my favorite World War II movies, Stalag 17.
That's true.
Then slowly started directing as he petered off and grew older as an actor, became a shooter, shot TV for over a decade, actually a decade and a half, I think, and then directed two notable films. He directed a bunch of films amid like dozens of TV shows, but he directed Escape from Planet of the Apes and then The Final Countdown. And I feel like if we get out of the show without going,
I'm proud of us because we said the words Final Conflict about 10 times.
It's the Final Conflict.
Didn't do that joke. We're growing as people. Look at us.
Not really.
Look at us growing
Santos
up.
Santos growing up. it's interesting because that's who they brought in when they fired Mike Hodges. They just brought in a shooter. They brought in somebody who would listen to them and do whatever they wanted to do, which is probably why Lance Henriksen didn't get along with him, because he was just a shooter and probably didn't really give a shit. You know, he was, God, when he shot this movie, he was in his late 60s.
Yeah, he only made one movie after this, which was the
Final Countdown, but shot more TV. Because that's what you do when you, here's a little inside baseball for college. Ever wonder why, you know, if you look, I love this director. Oh, he's been directing TV and he just did an episode of this and an episode of that. The reason why that is the DGA minimum for directing an episode of television is $30,000. The minimum for the DGA that a director needs to make in order to keep their health insurance is $30,000. It is specifically set so that once you've hit that point where you're not really directing anymore, you can step on once a year and direct a single TV show. They can get you for peanuts, and then you get to keep your insurance and you're covered and you're good. So you will find that, you know, directors will, you'll see, oh, he directed an episode of this and this year and an episode of this and this year. It was because he was retired but wanted to keep his insurance. And so that's a lot of what you'll see. And so, yeah, this is towards the end. He does a great job. There are great performances here. It's shot really well. It feels very classic. It's well done. I feel like a lot of that, of course, was Mike Hodges' setup. Mike Hodges is a great director, an underrated director. Again, if you didn't take a drink last time we said it, take a drink because we'll be talking Croupier eventually. Croupier is on the short list of things I want to cover, which was Mike Hodges' last great movie. But yeah, Don did a good job. Don Taylor did a good job and stepped into some big shoes and made what is the second movie in my childhood to give me nightmares. I had lots of nightmares about this movie.
And that brings us to the junk food pairing. And the junk food pairing, I think I'm going to go with Domino's Pizza.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you're going for the Rube Goldberg machine joke?
No. I'm sorry. I think I mispronounced it. What I meant to say was
Domino's
Pizza.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
That's why I'm going with Domino's.
God damn it. God damn it, Brian.
I'm just gonna dig this hole, set up some punji sticks, and let Cargill fall right into it.
You know what? Domino's redid their pizzas like a decade ago, and they're pretty fucking good.
That's what I keep hearing.
I like their artisanal pizzas. They make a sausage and bell pepper pizza that's pretty goddamn good.
I mean,
I live smack dab in the middle of Austin proper, where there's lots of really good pizza joints around that are local.
Oh yeah.
So I have a very hard time ordering from anyone these days because it's like, why wouldn't I order from Conan's? Well, if you don't want Conan's, why don't you go to Eastside Pies? And if you don't want Eastside Pies, why not Spartan? And like, seriously, there's so many great pizza options.
Yeah, but every
before
once
you
in
even
a while,
get to Austin's Pizza.
Every once in a while, there's a particular itch that a place like Domino's will scratch. Much like if you have a very particular love for Devil Child movies and you want to see all of the good to decent ones, a movie like
all three of them,
a movie like Damien the Omen 2 will definitely scratch that itch for you. So I understand your problem, but then again, I'm on a diet right now that does not allow me to eat pizza, and I want to eat my own arm off. If my own arm had pepperonis on it, I would fucking devour it right now. That's all I'm going to say. But yeah, I'm going with Domino's for the junk food pairing. Guys, thank you so much for joining us for this particularly evil episode of Junk Food Cinema. If you like what you heard, you can always find our back catalog on Blog Talk Radio and iTunes. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Twitter, Instagram. At Massaworm.
Massaworm does sound like something that's writ in some holy...
Massaworm!
And the 12-eyed Massaworm will devour all of the sinners.
It's the whore... I recognize that. It's the whore of Massaworm. Motherfucker, that's my wife. Shut the fuck up. I'm going to kick your ass.
Well, that was fun. You can find me on Twitter at FryGuy.
If you've watched the movie recently, one of the things I did want to bring up is, wow, you know, for an obscure piece of art that's been buried in the ground for like 2,000 years, everybody sure recognizes it on sight.
Yeah.
Wow, is that the Whore of Babylon? How would you know that?
Everyone's a goddamn art scholar because everyone is so fucking white in this movie, hence the square faces. Again, you can find, speaking of being white and square faced, at FryGuy Salisbury on Twitter. You can also follow the show at Junk Food Cinema and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. If you really like the show.
I mean, really like the show.
If you like it more than we like doing the choir bit, you can always go to Patreon, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. And for as little as $1 an episode.
Junk Food Cinema.
We will pass the collection plate around, and for as little as $1 an episode, you will get access to bonus content that nobody else gets to hear. And we really do appreciate it. But... until next time, guys, just be on the lookout for evil children and watch for falling rocks and don't let those elevator cables cut you in half.